from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up in Forums next hour, local Bay Area native author and award-winning journalist Peter Laufer will join us in studio for the hour to discuss his newest book, Forbidden Creatures, Inside the World of Animal Smuggling and Exotic Pets. What compels people to keep exotic animals as pets? And is there a line between what separates the wild ones and the domestic ones? And why is animal smuggling a $10 billion to $20 billion illegal business only eclipsed by drugs and guns? Peter Laufer joins us for Forums next hour. We'll include your calls, emails, and online questions and comments after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to the second hour of this morning's Forum program. Last time Peter Laufer was on Forum, we spoke with him about his book, The Dangerous World of Butterflies, which, aside from bringing forth his appreciation, aesthetic and otherwise, for all kinds of Lepidoptera, as butterflies are technically known, and also took into account the smuggling and illegal sides of butterfly selling. And in his most recent book, the Bay Area-born award-winning journalist takes us into the smuggling of larger animals, primates and pythons and big cats and a whole menagerie of animals poached, traded, bred, and smuggled in a network of traders, hunters, and customers, making up an estimated $10 to $20 billion illegal business. That's a year, by the way, which puts international animal smuggling, for how much it earns for lawbreakers, behind only illegal drug and gun trafficking. The author of Forbidden Creatures, Inside the World of Animal Smuggling and Exotic Pets, Peter Laufer, is now chair of journalism at the University of Oregon School of Journalism and Communications and author of over a dozen books. And he joins us in studio for this hour. Good to have you back.
And it's so nice to be here, Michael.
Well, you begin with, actually, I remember when you were on Jon Stewart talking about butterflies, and you said, what kind of people were these? I wanted to track down who these people are that smuggle butterflies. And you're sort of dealing with the same question with a melange of characters here, and pet owners and people who do the smuggling and so forth. They are quite an assortment of menagerie in their own right.
No question. And initially, I started to look as a journalist at this problem of border crossing. How are the animals smuggled? How much do they earn the smugglers? What happens to the smugglers? Who's after them? And that all is of interest. But what started to captivate me, and then I couldn't let go of, was these people. Who are these people, and why do they want to hang out with tigers and chimpanzees and Burmese pythons?
And we'll find that out in the course of this hour. But you also were, it seemed to me, very engaged with a kind of philosophical question. What's the line between what's wild and domestic? This keeps coming back in the book. Not only, I suppose, one could say for pets like conventional pets like dogs, but these exotic pets, and maybe even for human beings.
Yeah, no question. What's wild? What's domestic? What's tamed? What's feral? These seemed to me, when I started the research for this book, to be clearly defined. And by the time I got to the end of the project, I don't think that there is any definition there at all that really makes any sense, except, Michael, that we're all latently wild. I think that really is the conclusion that's appropriate, and that's what I come to.
Some more than others, of course, one need add. But you're also grappling with just the word pet and what it means. PETA says we should talk about guardianships, I think, in these animal rights groups. And you talked to a couple of Mark Rowlands and Peter Singer, a couple of big names in the field. But whether we ought to express ownership, that, you know, this is our pet and we own this pet. There's a kind of an animal rights issue here, ethically.
There's an animal rights issue, and there are plenty of people doing intriguing work looking at it as an animal rights issue. And I more looked at it and do look at it as a personal issue. I'm trying to grapple with what is my relationship with this cat that showed up at our door that my wife welcomed into the house and I probably would have kicked out. And what does it mean to have the responsibility of the animal? And do we own it? And what is a pet? And then I know that, at least I think I know you'll appreciate this, the use of the word itself. What's a penthouse pet as opposed to my pet cat?
Oh, you're dealing with, like I say, some real philosophical questions here. You get into the myth and history of many of these stories of like the Egyptian tombs and Androcles and Marco Polo and everything. And it's a lot of very colorful stuff. But let's get back for just a moment to the smuggling business, which is a big business. And we're talking about something that not only brings diseases in, but helps create a crisis, as you point out, for a growing number of endangered and wild species.
And a crisis for a growing number of endangered and wild species that become more and more valuable as they become rarer. And then just a crisis in terms of management of product, if you want to look at it coldly. The birds that come in from South America, the loss rate, the shrinkage, whatever the right term is for merchandising these things, up to 90% of these animals dying in transit before they even get into the illegal marketplace. It is amoral and mindless. Amoral when it is the professionals and mindless when it is the amateurs. And there are plenty of amateurs out there who figure, oh, wouldn't this be nice to bring home, or I can make a couple of bucks if I bring this home.
But as you point out, the professional side of this is pretty sophisticated, and it's international.
It is sophisticated, it's international, and it parallels the drugs trade and the arms trade that you mentioned.
But without the risks.
Exactly. Yeah. The mechanics are the same. Often the players are the same, but you get put away potentially for a long time for the drugs and the arms, and you get a slap maybe if you get caught doing the same with animals.
Well, let's talk about some of the people who are involved in wanting these animals as pets. And, of course, you use a story that became sort of a headline story, this woman up in Stamford, Connecticut, who had a chimpanzee and whose friend literally had her face torn off by the chimp. It's not exactly J. Fred Muggs. You brought up my memory train, going back to Dave Garraway with that happy chimp that went on roller skates and did all those kinds of things. And Franz de Waal, I think you quote as saying, this is not necessarily freakish for chimpanzees. They're wild animals and they do, you know, they can be loving and sweet and all that, but they're not necessarily meant to be house pets. And this woman was really cosseting this pet like it was her own child. It was a surrogate child, really, in that case, wasn't it?
No question. And she referred to Travis, is the name of this chimpanzee, in that manner. And inside her house, she had Travis's drawings up on the refrigerator, just as you might have your children's drawings on the refrigerator. She did things that some of us might consider strange, like sharing wine with the chimpanzee out of stemmed glasses in the bed that they shared together. But she referred to the animal as if it were her child. And when you mention, Michael, this the fact that the animal is wild, and so when it reaches adolescence, it's a crapshoot about what may happen. There's also a strange parallel that goes on with a lot of these animals. Were they taken from the wild and then used in this domesticated or so-called domesticated manner, or were they raised captive bred? And what is the difference between the captive bred and the wild, and what happens at adolescence? Well, it's certain that at adolescence it's going to have the potential to go wild whether it was captive bred or not, but intriguingly enough, at least to me, it's going to violate all sorts of laws, international and American, if you deal with a wild chimpanzee, unless you go through all sorts of paperwork that's going to be pretty much impossible for you to do. And there's almost no law if you're dealing with a captive bred chimpanzee.
Well, there also aren't any laws where tigers are concerned in many states. I was quite surprised to read. I mean, in addition to chimpanzees, because a lot of people think chimpanzees make good pets, but tigers?
Well, there are a lot of people that think that tigers make good pets, depending on your definition of pet
Mike
and
Tyson,
your definition of good. And Mike Tyson is one of the poster boys for this, for sure, and others. And tigers are legal to maintain in plenty of places in these United States, including the example that I like to point out, which is Texas, where all indications are that there are more captive-bred tigers living in Texas than there are wild tigers in India, although the census is not scientific. We don't know for certain.
But again, you mentioned Mike Tyson. You find out how many celebrities or, you know, drug dealers or, you know, people of means, obviously, but people who have a lot of money to spend go in for these kind of so-called exotic pets. And then you get into the whole nature of what is an exotic pet. But, I mean, pets that people normally don't have. And there are a legion number of examples of people who are willing to spend money almost like a status symbol. In fact, you found there were a lot of analogies to people saying, it's just like having a Ferrari, having a tiger, that kind of thing, yeah?
There is the status symbol aspect, and there is the power.
There's dominating, yeah.
The dominating, and there is an intimidation factor, too. I think that's why you see the drug dealers with the, not just the exotic pets, but also with the exotic zoos, with the menageries, to show that not only can I control this animal, but if you mess with me, it might not be controlled when I let it out on you. Now, whenever I talk this way, I get incoming from one particular character who's in the book who says, what's wrong with those of us who just like these animals and they're our pets? Why do you have to draw these parallels?
Michael Jackson, right? You know,
like Michael Jackson, who certainly is another one of these players who has celebrity, access to funds, and then chooses to exercise that opportunity of having a personal zoo. It goes back to William Randolph Hearst. One of the things I learned researching this book that I never knew growing up here in San Francisco is that William Randolph Hearst's private zoo, which he decided was a little bit too pricey for him throughout the Depression, became Fleischacker Zoo, now called San Francisco Zoo, mm-hmm. and that the initial animal population there was put together from Hearst's collection. Another connection that we have with William Randolph Hearst here in the Bay Area that I didn't know about.
Talking to Peter Laufer, his new book is Forbidden Creatures Inside the World of Animal Smuggling and Exotic Pets. But, you know, you went down to Florida and you talked to these people about, well, Burmese pythons in the Everglades. There's a whole chapter on that, a non-native species. And one of them tried to, I guess, eat a young child, a girl. And you've got these owners there, Aaron Joyce, who talks about the importance of the control and dominance, you know, of having an exotic pet. But then his wife is talking about, well, it's the money and, you know, and then she's trying to say people who buy these exotic pets, they want to be cool. So you have so many different factors involved in why people do this. You think about somebody like Michael Jackson. I said, sweet, you know, people will say, come on, he was a pedophile and all that. But he was somebody who obviously loved to be around all these pets and exotic animals, like he'd like to be around children. I mean, there's something sort of that can't be understood here that drives people. It's just too diverse, isn't it?
And part of it is the anthropomorphic reality of looking at a chimpanzee or a monkey of some kind, and seeing us in them. And that doesn't extend to the snakes for me, but there's something there also with the tigers and the lions.
And those people had a snake named Satan, and I thought, boy, there's something in this that's, you know, something demonic appealing to them or diabolical.
Huh? And throughout our history across cultures, our history with any kind of record keeping, the snakes take some kind of a role that, if not being demonic, it has some kind of intrigue.
Come on, they got us kicked out of Eden. You know?
That's one to point out, yes.
There's so many different characters in here. I wanted to go back to some of the early characters that you portray. You've got a smuggler up there in Oregon who conspired with her daughter. Actually, you go there in Spokane. And here are these people who went to these great lengths to bring this creature in, Apu, the woman disguising herself as being pregnant and everything, you know, and again, you sort of marvel at this and say, why go to all that trouble? But they love the pet. I mean, they
seemingly loved the animal. They certainly went to a lot of trouble. They traveled to
Thailand. This is another primate, we should say.
Pardon?
We should talk about what the animal is.
Yes, it's a monkey. And yeah. it's a cute little monkey. They went to Thailand. They bought the monkey, according to all the court records. They were found guilty of multiple felonies. They bought the monkey in Thailand for $20. They could have bought the monkey in this country. It would have cost them maybe $5,000. So if you figure the vacation, it was a wash. They got the vacation in Thailand and the monkey for the same amount as the monkey would have cost here. They did, in fact, drug the monkey and bring the monkey back to this country through Korea, Hong Kong, LAX, and then up to Spokane across all of these borders, post 9/11, this was just a couple of years ago, through all of that security. And
risking all kinds of diseases, perhaps.
I mean, potentially, although the monkey did end up testing out clean.
It's funny because I was reading a subtext in your narrative. On the one hand, you know, you were morally condemnatory toward them putting people at threat and risking. They're sort of likable people, though. At least they came off in your prose as being likable.
Well, if not likable, they were people that I could relate to. I have known people like that living up in Oregon, in Nevada. These were survivalist types, and I felt very comfortable when I was welcomed into the kitchen for the interview with the mother. It was a mother and daughter act. And
a little suspicious of you being a vegetarian at first, maybe, but that you got past that.
No question. And we did get past that when I told her I carved the turkey at Thanksgiving because I'm better at it than the rest of the family. But there was I'd been in houses like this. I knew this woman, this type of woman. And I could relate to her in that manner. But at the same time, what they did to this monkey just doesn't seem reasonable, aside from breaking the law. It was smuggling. It was the mindlessness of it, though, I think, that intrigued me the most. All of this creativity and success, and then the daughter paraded around Spokane telling anybody that she could find to listen that they'd smuggled this monkey into the country. One of those people picked up the phone and called the Fish and Wildlife Service.
The other thing I think that people have to be mindful of, and that is horrifying, especially to those who love animals, is that some of these animals are brought in just to kill, I mean, to shoot and hunt and so forth. There are these places in Texas, for example, where you can hunt wild animals, and that's part of the appeal for hunters to come there.
So that was the Dick Cheney event, when he blew his friend's face.
Exactly.
Then he was on one of these canned hunts. Often those animals are not brought in for this purpose. Those animals come from places like these questionable roadside zoos that you may happen on a highway trip where it says, see the camel or whatever it says. After these animals are no longer viable in the capacity of a carnival or a circus or a roadside zoo, they get sold to the canned hunt places where they passively sit in quarters that are fenced, and a Dick Cheney type macho guy will be handed a rifle and will be able to bring a trophy home for a steep price.
And it's legal.
It's legal. Yeah. There's not much in this business that is illegal in Texas.
You mentioned camels. To this day, it defies belief, but you spent many years living in Fairfax over in Marin County, and I actually saw somebody walking a camel down the street in San Anselmo.
Are you sure it wasn't a llama?
No, it was a camel.
You're sure? No.
I'm absolutely
because
certain.
Because there are llamas up the street from where I lived in Fairfax.
There are a lot of llamas in West Marin and so forth, but this was definitely a camel, and how it got there or what it was doing there. I mean, the fact is that there are strange and exotic animals. They're ubiquitous. They're all over. A lot of them are, of course, in homes. We don't know about them, but they are everywhere.
And that could be a wonderful thing. I try hard not to be judgmental. I don't want a big cat, a great ape, or a long snake in my house. And I would be concerned if my neighbor had something that I thought might get out sometime and bother me. But if somebody is doing this somewhere where it's well cordoned off from the rest of us, it's not to my taste, as Peter Singer said about sexual relations with animals. It's not to my taste, but I'm loath to be too judgmental. I just would like to know how the animal feels about it.
Which is, of course, very difficult to know, but even though Peter Singer and Jeff Mason and many of these other animal rights people tell us that animals do have feelings, that we need to be mindful and aware of those feelings. But let me get back to the case in Stamford, Connecticut, and the chimp attack, because after that, and it's haunting, included in your book, the 9/11 call. And
ghastly call,
yeah,
yes.
It's horrible. But then you went to the Missouri compound where this particular chimp was born and raised.
That's right. And where that is completely legal, it's a place called Chimp Party, and there are several places like that in Missouri. The laws are slowly changing around the country and slowly changing even in Missouri. But at the time I was there, it was completely legal, is still, to captive breed and raise chimpanzees for sale. If you'd like one, Michael, I might be able to fix you up for about $75,000 for a baby chimpanzee that you could then raise and keep in your house, depending on the laws where you live. And I met with the woman who...
You're getting in the trade on the side here? Is that what you're saying?
I'm just trying to facilitate if you have a desire. It's there's no money involved.
Midwife.
Here. Just out of my respect and concern for your needs and desires. I met with the woman who captive bred Travis, the chimpanzee that did ultimately tear the face off of the friend of the owner. And she was very firm in saying that Travis wasn't to blame and how could you know for certain what happened, and cited statistics. And the statistics, and I went to the Centers for Disease Control to check these out, and it makes sense because we've got a whole lot more dogs and cats around than we have chimpanzees and tigers. But if you look at the damage and fatal interaction between these so-called exotic pets and their owners and neighbors, and compare that to dog attacks, say, but dogs are much more trouble to us.
This illegal pet trade, though, it has had a devastating effect. You single out, I mean, this may not mean much to listeners, at least on the face of it, like Philippine forest turtles, you know, they're endangered. And there are many, the gibbons in Indonesia, and, you know, you can go through so many of these different species. And the fact is, for a lot of these folks, they're collectors. They're almost like fetishists, as you point out. They want this particular species, and it's rare, and it's endangered, and what do we need to do to stop the smuggling?
Well, I suppose the Fish and Wildlife Service and their colleagues worldwide would say the first thing we need to do is we need to give more resources to the protection of wildlife. If you look at the money, the amount of money the Drug Enforcement Administration has compared with the amount of money the Fish and Wildlife Service has for their budgets, it's infinitesimal at the Fish and Wildlife Service level. And there needs to be, if this is at all feasible to think of when one thinks of all of the myriad of problems in the world, there needs to be training of those who are enforcing this law in the source countries, and there needs to be some kind of equilibrium on wealth in the world, because as long as that forest turtle that you talked about, if it's sold to a trader by a poacher, is going to allow that poacher, who's a peasant in the middle of nowhere, to be able to feed his children, he's going to have a very hard time, as you and I would probably, making a decision to favor the turtle instead of dinner for his family.
There's always going to be an appetite for these pets, though. I was thinking about, for years, a next-door neighbor of mine had a pet ocelot, and it was like a performance. You know, they say, oh, the ocelot, they train the ocelot to use a toilet. Come and see an ocelot using a toilet, which was, you know, sort of a spectacle. And people like these kind of humanist factor, anthropomorphic, whatever you want to call it.
And just the different. It's the different thing. It's intriguing, and it's fun to see these guys up close and personal, so to speak, which I've had the opportunity to throughout the research for this book. It's amazing to get right next to an animal that's got no business being where it is.
But, you know, many people will tell you they make loving pets in many instances, don't they? There is that side of it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And who's to question that if we disagree?
Well, let's find out what our listeners think about this. We frame this in a number of different ways. I mean, philosophically, what do you think about the whole idea of keeping these animals, let alone questions you might have about the smuggling, which is a big international operation and handsomely pays and doesn't necessarily mean great punitive consequences, and the question about the line between wild and domestic, and how do we determine the line, or should we even be wrestling with grappling with such a big question? Our phone lines are available to you, and they're open, so call us. Do you have an exotic pet, or do you know someone who does? You may want to join us on that score as well. Toll-free number, 866-733-6786. You can join us now again toll-free, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite, 866-733-6786, or send an email to forum@kqed.org, or post a question or comment on our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny, and Bay Area-based, well, no longer Bay Area-based, Bay Area native, Peter Loffer's with us, author and journalist, talking about his new book, Forbidden Creatures, which explores the world of animal smuggling and exotic pets. In fact, the subtitle is Inside the World of Animal Smuggling and Exotic Pets, and he is now the James N. Wallace Chair in Journalism at University of Oregon School of Journalism and Communication. And we welcome your calls if you have some thoughts about this Well, it's an extraordinary business, really, smuggling pets and smuggling animals for all kinds of reasons, in addition to having them as domestic pets or wild pets or whatever you choose to call them. And some choose not to call them pets at all. We welcome your calls, our toll-free number again, and particularly like to hear from some of you who have had experience with maybe having what we generally term exotic pets in your home, whether they were things that crawl or things that fly or, you know, I could get into biblical scripture here, but I won't. Instead, we'll get into your calls. And again, our toll-free number is 866-733-6786. You can also, of course, send an email to forum@kqed.org or post a question or comment on our website, which is kqed.org/forum, and you click on this segment. Kevin is our first caller. Kevin, hi.
Hey, good morning. I have a quick comment and a question. I learned recently, I don't know if I'm the only one who didn't know this, but the lovable chimps we see in movies and TV that are so well-trained and clever are actually babies, and they become unruly at 2 or 3 years of age. They become too strong and ornery, and they have to basically be gotten rid of by their owners. And then my question is, how many, or does the author know of how many of these exotic species, I'm thinking more of insects, plants, and other animals, can escape into the wild and cause serious environmental problems when they there's just no check on their breeding, et cetera?
Well, excuse me, I have Peter answer that, but one of the environmental problems, as you allude to in your book, is a lot of, like, these Burmese pythons are non-native species, and so they present problems with the environment.
Yeah, Burmese python is perhaps the best example. First, to that first point, that there's no question that once any of us reach adolescence, we might be a little unruly, and it's certainly the case with chimpanzees that those that are used for the movies and television are going to become unpredictable and probably no longer used at that point. Body weight to muscle strength, 4 to 7 times more with the chimpanzee than with you and me, Michael, which also is a factor. And then there are those monster canine teeth that are designed to do damage to flesh, and in fact, as we saw tragically in Stamford, Connecticut, they certainly do. Sometimes the movie chimpanzees, especially in the past before there was so much concern about animals in terms of animal rights or whatever you want to call it, were just removed so that that was not a factor. One of the chimpanzees I saw at Chimp Party, the place in Missouri, looked like an old man because of that, an old man with no teeth because of that kind of gumming. Sad, tragic that the animal would have the teeth pulled. The classic case of a non-native invasive causing problems is the Burmese python. The Burmese python, about 25, 30 years ago, started to be brought over from Southeast Asia in quantity as a pet. It's a beautiful, beautiful animal, even if you're not particularly fond of snakes. It's jewel-like. And Southeast Asia, South Florida, very compatible environments. A Burmese python.
So now we've got them all over the Everglades.
Yes, because these things may be kind of cute when they're 2 and 3 feet long. If you like snakes, put one around your neck, have the gold chains around your neck, your shirt unbuttoned to the navel, parade down South Beach, and you've got what I heard over and over again in Florida is a pretty good chick magnet. However, when you continue to feed that Burmese python, it likes to eat, and it becomes 200 pounds and maybe 24 feet and is making a real mess in its quarters because all that food goes somewhere, then you might think, I've got enough chicks and I'd like to get rid of this snake. And
you don't mean the chicks that they eat, by the way, little chicks.
The pejorative in some quarters word for the women that these guys are after.
Word no longer acceptable in polite discourse.
Or at least on public radio. And off they may go with the pickup truck, dump the snake in the Everglades, and now it is a consequential problem. These are apex predators. They are fearless. They tangle with alligators. The 50, 60 eggs per cycle with the women. All indications are there's not a lot of research done yet, even in its own range in Southeast Asia, but all indications are the female only has to interact once with a male and then can repeatedly have these 50, 60 egg cycles. And the Everglades are full of these animals that are causing all kinds of problems with endangered species in the Everglades that they want to eat.
As if there's not enough strangeness down in Florida. When Dave Barry was on, we were talking about Carl Hyacin gave a talk at a writer's conference I was at, and he was talking about somebody calling out in a trailer park, calling the fish and game people because there was a woman in one of the trailers who had a pet alligator, but there was apparently some, how shall we say, there was some biblical knowledge between her and the alligator that was going on. I mean, this is Carl Hyacin using this as an example of things that go on in Florida that don't go on anywhere else. You could argue, and I suppose many do, that these animals, well, it's one thing to talk about non-native species, but that these animals don't belong in homes and they don't belong in zoos. They belong in their natural environment. And that is a fairly tenable argument.
One can make that argument. Those who keep them, they'll say, what's wrong with this? The snake is perfectly happy. I'm enjoying it. I have it in a secure in secure quarters. And what I have heard over and over again is this is my property, which then gets into another intriguing philosophical question. This is America. I have a right to my private property. I've heard this many times framed as an issue of an American property right. And so don't tell me what I should do with this animal, which, speaking of the Bible tells me that I have power over.
This is my animal and this is my gun.
Exactly.
I'm going to go together. You know, you think about Mike Tyson and his tiger and Paris Hilton and her kinkajou and it's almost, I mean, it's, I don't want to get too wrapped up in analogies here, but you know, there are a lot of jokes made about Hollywood stars adopting third world children and everything. It's almost a little bit of that, isn't there, that it has that kind of, well, cachet to it, I guess.
It definitely has cachet, and I can take care of it, and because I am who I am, I've got it. It's illegal to have a kinkajou in Los Angeles. That did not stop Paris Hilton from having a kinkajou, and we all found out about it, not because of any hardcore investigative reporting, but because the kinkajou ran a bit amok on her, and she had to go to the hospital, and that's how it was discovered that she was harboring this.
She's known more for her chihuahua, of course, but we're going to go to more calls here, and we're going to go to a caller in Memphis, Tennessee. Steve, hi.
Good afternoon. How are you, gentlemen?
Doing okay.
Hey, pleasure being on the radio today. Author, it's a very fascinating subject that you're covering, and I believe I will have a read of the book, but I have an opportunity. But a point of clarification, what specifically was the quarry of the hunting party when the tragic accident occurred with former Vice President Cheney? Wasn't that something more mundane?
It was definitely something more mundane, but the concept is still the same. And it is these types of hunts where you sign up, write a check, and you are for sure to get your quarry. So the concept is the same.
He was
the
hunting
animal
quail,
was
though,
different.
Actually,
yeah, he was. Yeah. He was. But any chance I can have to make fun of Vice President Cheney, I'm happy to.
Thank you, Steve, for the call. And let me go to Geraldine next. Good morning, Geraldine.
Hi, how are you? I really want to read this book. I've had over 30 species of animals in my life, and we had a monkey when I was a child in the 50s, and it showed me that wild animals, you know, you definitely need knowledge, and it wasn't available then. So I'm all for stopping smuggling and of endangered species. The problem is there's a big problem with the animal rights movement trying to pass draconian laws. I mean, we've got in California, it's even illegal to have gerbils, all kinds of other species that are exotic but do make wonderful pets. I used to have, when I lived in Oregon where they were legal, had hedgehogs, which are an incredible tool to teach kids how to watch body language of animals, because if they don't, the quills come out, it won't hurt the child, you know, it'll get their attention. But it is an amazing tool, and that's, of course, illegal in California, and their federal laws every year come up that will make things like my lady gooly and finches, which are endangered in the wild and are only going to survive because private people have them illegal. And it's just, it seems a lot of the people in this movement, the cure is going to be, you know, worse than the disease.
And you say what to that, Peter Loughlin?
I hear this a lot, that why this infringement on what I want to do, and what is the reason that government and the animal rights and animal liberation types want to infringe on my hobby, my desire to interact with these other species.
But and, forgive me, you put that libertarian argument aside, and what you realize is the trade for these wild and protected animals is expanding, and it's growing exponentially, in fact, and these are animals that need to be protected.
And there's no question, and that's a cut-and-dried, black-and-white issue. But if they are captive bred in circumstances that are acceptable to society, is that wrong? And should this caller not have the opportunity to have her, was it hedgehog? She's gone.
Yeah. Yeah. Logical extension of these arguments that the more extreme people like Peter Singer in the animal rights movement, they believe we shouldn't have cats and dogs as pets. You know, some people, like me, you know, I love pets. I don't like football. More people are injured in playing football a year than by exotic animals. So should we ban football? Basically, people have passions for things, and if the animal is well treated, you know, obviously we have to stop smuggling, and we cannot keep animals in ways that are injurious or not beneficial for them. But the problem is, so much of the thrust of this argument is by people who, you know, want to, you know, take away my hedgehog, and then they will eventually, if you look at deep behind what they're saying, when they thought we weren't listening, they want to take away our cats and dogs too. And that sounds extreme, I know, but I've met these people and I've been dealing with animal legislation for about 5 years. And I'm frankly frightened with the legislation that's coming up. Yeah. Although education, obviously people, you know, when we got, my mother bought the monkey one in 1950, you know, it was ridiculous that we didn't have the knowledge to have a really good life, and it, you know, it ended up in a zoo, and but that taught me a lot.
I don't think you're going to see control over people's cats and dogs. I mean, it's almost sacrosanct in this country. However, there's an analogy that comes to mind, and that is there are a lot of people who say we've got to ban pit bulls because they're dangerous. Because and pit bull owners would tell you these can be the sweetest and most obedient and good-hearted dogs if they're not raised to be aggressive.
And I think your caller, Michael,
and that's what people say about exotic pets, too, often.
Yes, and I think your caller puts that point of view out in a really cogent manner. And I can see a movement to try to prevent cats and dogs from being pets. It is a logical extension in some people's minds, and I think thinking that through is intriguing. I have to, if we have a second here, tell you one thing, though, speaking of hedgehogs. And I was just looking in a book. I can't find it. But it my first exotic pet joke came from Britain, and it's a hedgehog joke, and it's hedgehogs. Why can't they share? That's the joke.
That's the joke.
That's
the
joke.
Yeah, I got
it. Okay. Well, he didn't laugh uproariously, but
it's a good joke.
Okay, thank you.
Here's a listener who writes, those who purchase exotic pets are practicing something akin to slavery. You adopt a stray cat or dog because it's better in your home than in the streets. You leave a python in the jungle because it's better in the wild than in your home. Another listener says, is there a growing trend of the – this is Val from Turlock. Is there a growing trend of the illegal exotic pet trade increasing in other countries besides the U.S.?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's the United States, it's Japan, it's Germany, and the pets come from the so-called South, and it's the rich folks for the most part in the North that can afford the luxury of it, although there are other places. The guy who is the strong man, I cannot remember his name, in Chechnya has a tiger, and he likes to have his tiger at news conferences.
So does Teodoro Restrepo, the drug kingpin, doesn't he also have a tiger?
I think it's almost required now, if you have the title drug kingpin, to have the tiger or the lion.
And you mentioned in your book the Tarzan of Spanish movies.
Yes, and that was a very sad story where his tiger got out, and before he had an opportunity to corral it, the local authorities shot and killed the tiger, and
he was heartbroken.
He was heartbroken, and it's understandable. If you like, do you have a pet, Michael?
Not at the present.
But if you've had a cat or a dog, you had a relationship with it then?
Sure.
If you had, and
I've had dogs all my life. It's just my last dog died not too long ago, and we don't want to go there because I can get, you know, easily
teary-eyed.
Well, thinking about my dog, I can't.
Yeah, and so someone could about a tiger, a lion, a chimpanzee?
And do, all the time, sure. Russ wants to know, are persons trafficking in rare animals or endangered species or habitat lists likely to claim they are engaged in legitimate breeding programs to restore viable populations?
It happens all the time, and that's the argument in Texas. Why not have these captive-bred tigers? You've got a diminishing population of wild tigers in Asia, and if we are going to maintain the species, captive bred in Texas, isn't that terrific? There are a couple of arguments against that. One is it's a mongrel population in Texas, so it's not really the equivalent of the wild tiger. The other deals with the poaching that goes on of wild tigers for traditional Asian medicinals, and the concern is that at a time when there is some success at restricting that trade, if there is all kinds of tiger parts available from these tigers in Texas and elsewhere, then what is that going to do in terms of feeding the appetite, which will then put pressure on the wild tigers?
It's not only the medicinal. There are a lot of mythic stories about restoring virility and,
isn't that broadly medicinal?
Well, I was thinking about literally medicinal in the sense of something prescriptive or whatever. Here's a listener, Danny, who says, I live in New Zealand, and it's an abject lesson in invasive species. The woman who boosted hedgehogs should see the damage they and other invasive species do when they get loose, as they will. And another listener, Benjamin, writes, I had to care for my sister's kinkajou back when I was a kid in Massachusetts. It ate bananas, smelled bad, created a huge amount of waste, and got food all over itself. Once when I was charged with feeding and caring for him, he turned on me and bit me in the arm. The bite was very dirty, and I got septicemia. Wild animals are by definition not domesticated. So beyond all of the philosophical problems with keeping wild animals, they're messy and dangerous.
Messy and dangerous they are.
And more calls. We'll go to Oakland. Maya, hi.
Hi. Just a couple of comments. I've pretty much dedicated my life to working in the arena of the human-animal bonds. I'm a huge supporter of people having animals. However...
Whoops, I don't know what happened. We'll have to try to get her back on, or she can call us back here. Just thinking about the Siegfried Roy incident, Roy getting attacked by his tiger. I mean, even when tigers you think are working for you and are there as your pretty little big pussycats or whatever, boom.
And that was a tiger that was captive bred, that he bottle fed, that he trained, and something happened. Just as something can happen in any kind of a relationship. But that event, which was before a live audience in Las Vegas, the Travis event, the attack on the woman in Stamford, Connecticut, and then one of the Burmese pythons that did in fact kill a little 2-year-old girl in a trailer park outside of Orlando, those three events have done a lot to raise the profile of exotic pets as a concern, much to the chagrin of those who keep them and want to be left alone.
And the people who keep them, like those people in Florida who you were talking to, Aaron Joyce and his wife, they say...
And they sell them. They have a pet store. They sell them.
And they say the danger is with the pet owners. They're not responsible pet owners. They always put the blame on... It's like people say, again, about pit bulls, and they may be right.
Or about guns.
Or about guns, right. On we go. Noel, good morning.
Hello?
Yes, hi, you're on the air.
This is Noelle, and I saw on TV this girl had a tiger, and it almost tore her head off.
And you saw that on TV?
Yeah.
And you're how old, Noelle?
I'm 8.
You're 8. You shouldn't see things like that on TV. I'm sorry that you had to see that. It was pretty scary, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah. So you don't want a pet tiger, I take it, huh? Like Tony the Tiger or somebody out of one of those, Roo, I'm thinking of, in Winnie the Pooh. You don't want one of those pet tigers, huh? Noelle, I don't know where she went, but thank you for calling. She wanted to tell us she saw a person almost. Okay, let me go to more calls. We'll go to Los Altos. Serena, hi.
Hi, Michael. Thank you. This is a kind of response to the woman and the hedgehog. I thought I heard her imply that we have a right to have whatever animal we want to have. And this this is what I guess I would call speciesism on the part of humans, that we have cultured this attitude since Genesis of dominion over, gosh, everything.
Palm and pine, as Kipling said.
Palm and pine.
Yeah, and fauna and flora. Right.
Yeah, yeah. And it's, taken to its extreme. extreme. It's the chimpanzee. It's an acquaintance of mine who did have her face taken off by a tiger at Marine World in Vallejo. Someone had given her the visit with the tiger as a birthday present, and it was, anyway, that's news. But
you got to watch what cages you're going into, too. Phil Bronstein can attest to that.
Oh, right.
Komodo dragon bit this
Right. Oh, my gosh. Anyway, it's, it's got to be a whole attitudinal shift, and we probably won't see it in our lifetimes, but that's my feeling about it. We've bred cats, we've bred dogs, we've bred certain kinds of birds. That's great. But to bring a grizzly cub or a tiger cub or a Komodo dragon kid is just madness.
Well, thank you for expressing your opinion, Serena. And Peter Loffer, we go back to that word speciesism again. That's Peter Singer's word. He coined it.
It is an awkward word that it is. And there are folks on both sides of that, as was suggested more than once this hour. It goes back to Genesis and before. We're in charge, and we should be able to do whatever we want with these guys. And every once in a while, one of them does something that it wants with us, and that's just the risk that is taken. And then there are those who do believe that cats and dogs should not be allowed to be pets because that infringes on their rights.
It's almost an argument, though, like there shouldn't be automobiles because it's polluting our atmosphere, which is true, of course, but, you know, good luck with trying to get that through in legislation. I mean, people see their pets as like their dogs and their automobiles.
That is so. However, the trend is nationwide in this country for more and more restrictions on the so-called exotic pets.
On we go to more of your exotic or non-exotic calls. I don't know. Amy, join us. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Thank you. Okay.
Thank you for covering this. My question is about Savannah cats, which seem to be for sale a lot in the Bay Area, and they're a hybrid of serval cats, wild serval cats, and domestic cats.
I saw the cutest little serval at an exotic pet auction in Macon, Missouri. It was so little, should not have been, I'm sure, away from its mother already, but the fur was softer, I think, than anything I've ever touched. So cute, and I know it's going to be misery for that owner just by having encountered her. In a couple of years, that cat is going to tear up that house. Or maybe not.
Absolutely. Well, they're beautiful, and people who have them love them, but it's just a practice that I feel like is awful. And
well, what do you think, Amy? They shouldn't be house pets?
I think that you shouldn't. It's a wild animal, so you shouldn't be taking a wild exotic animal, breeding it, manipulating that, and then having it as a pet. No,
but
I don't think
you know, you take a domestic cat and you let it go in the loose, it becomes a feral cat. It's a wild cat, too.
It's not a wild exotic cat from another country, though.
No, that's true. Thanks, Amy. Good to hear from you. And we'll hear next from Madeline. Hi.
Oh, hello. Thanks for taking my call. I was just going to say that in my family, we have kind of like a desert tortoise that we passed down through the generations. Like my great-great-uncle found him when he was jackrabbit hunting. And
this is the same desert tortoise? Because they can live a long time.
Yeah, the same desert tortoise. She's very healthy. She's with my cousins right now because I went away to college, so I gave her to my cousins. And she was just the best pet. Like, you know, a pet that just doesn't die on you. I think it was the greatest pet to have. So I don't know. And I read about them in the wild, how they're always getting, hit by cars, and they're really endangered now. And I really just think sometimes, you know, they're not legal to have as pets, I guess, but I guess I think sometimes exotic pets can be a really positive thing.
Okay. Thank you for your call. And we'll hear from some more of our listeners. We'll go to San Jose. Kathy, join us. Hi.
Hi, Mike. I want to comment on something on this matter that kind of ties into what your last caller was saying. My daughter's a vegetarian, but she and I were having a talk about animal rights the other day. And her take on it is, you know, she doesn't pressure other people to stop eating meat, and she doesn't pressure people to not have pets because she recognizes, and I think it's a good point, that there are a lot of species that are now dependent on humans for survival. And I'm thinking about some of the exotic animals that I've known people to have that were actually bred in captivity. I would never endorse people buying wild-caught exotic pets. But is there a place for exotic pets that are bred in captivity And what role does that play in ensuring that people preserve them?
I mean, yeah, it's a good question. Let me hear what Peter Lawfer has to say.
Well, this brings to mind a couple that I profile in the book, Susanna Kuko and Scott Shoemaker, and they have a spread outside of Pahrump in Nevada with and for my eyes, a perfectly decent bunch of cages for the cats that they enjoy having, and a perimeter fence that probably makes their neighbors sleep okay at night. And the cats that they have that they introduced me to meet this definition from the caller. They were what are called sometimes photo cats, and they're captive bred, and they might be at a shopping center when they're babies, and you can have your children's picture taken with them, and it's oh so cute. And then they grow up to a certain age and weight, and that's no longer legal in the places where something like this is legal. And then what happens to them? Well, a few of them are there with Susanna and Scott. I get this wonderful mental picture of Bam Bam, this tiger a lion that they estimate is 500 pounds, and they don't have a scale that can accommodate him. And Susanna going in there with a brush and a can of pepper spray, and she says, "I've got the pepper spray just in case he doesn't want to see me today." And she's not had any problem with him. They get along fine. They get along with the neighbors for the most part. And if this is okay anywhere, that's probably where it's okay. And the equation is the caller's equation. What else would happen to these?
And when you mention lions, though, of course, I think of Born Free. And, you know, it's such a heart-tugging story. They bring the lion up, Elsa, in a domestic way. And they form a bond, and it's an irretrievable bond. But then they let her out in the wild, and she comes to them, and she's like the pet who still recognizes and loves the owner. I mean, it's actually a true story, though, you know? And so people have these kind of models in their minds.
Sure, but these cats are, when they're captive bred, it's a different story.
Always a pleasure to have you, Peter. Thank you.
It's terrific to come. Thank you, Michael. It's
Peter Lawfer's book, Forbidden Creatures, Inside the World of Animal Smuggling and Exotic Pets. And tomorrow, during this hour, we're going to talk about a man who went to the deepest part of the earth. Hope you'll join us for that. We're going to talk about Afghanistan and the war, the endless war, in our opening hour tomorrow, which seems endless, but there are dates after all, so maybe not. Hope you will join us. Thank you for being a part of this morning's program. And thanks to our senior editor, Dan Zoll, to our producers, Kevin Guillory, Judy Campbell, Tina Larberg, Erica Kelly, and our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.